The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Spoiler alert, we're going to talk about Lionel Messi. He breaks Liverpool hearts at the Nou Camp as Barca win 3-0 in a game that Jurgen Klopp describes as the Reds' best performance in this competition over the last 2 years. In the game to decide who Barca beat in the final, Ajax play Spurs off the park for half an hour but only come away with a 1-0 win. Elsewhere, the latest on Iker Casillas, there's joy for Luton and Barnsley without kicking a ball while Bury are up from League Two. We'll give you all the permutations ahead of the final day of the Football League season. There's Zlatan versus Onua in MLS, a Premier League preview, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Ireland's finest Guardian football journalist Paul Doyle is here.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
Good.
It's nice to see you.
Absolutely. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks. Hey, Paolo Bandini.
Hi.
You well?
Yeah, pretty well.
Arsenal tonight, semi-final. You nervous?
Well, I don't know. I suppose my levels of expectation for Arsenal are so low at the moment that it's hard to even feel nervous. I hope things go well.
Yeah. I do too, for your sake, Paolo. Hi, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
It's nice to see you.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Do you mean that?
Well, you just said you spend too much time with me because we say what we had for breakfast as our sound level check. Mm-hmm. You said what you thought I would have had, and you were almost exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we are spending too much time together.
I don't doubt that for a second.
Let's start at the Camp Nou, or the Nou Camp, whichever one you want to say. Barcelona 3, Liverpool 0, only one place to start. Lionel Messi scored the second, curled in a ridiculous free kick, his 600th goal for Barcelona for the third. In a game, Paolo, where Barcelona weren't really dominant, but then it didn't matter.
Yeah, basically. It definitely... I suppose the second goal didn't sort of feel like that extraordinary Messi moment so much. And to a certain extent, even at 2-0, I think a lot of people might have thought, well, that's not the worst result. I mean, Barcelona have clearly been much more prone to bad results away from home in Europe than they have been at home. You get them back to the Kop, maybe you get something out of it. But that it felt like sort of simultaneously a bit of a nail in the coffin for Liverpool, and also just a jaw-dropping moment. I mean, they cut to Jurgen Klopp briefly on the sideline. He was just sort of had this slightly glazed look, but a smile on his face. And I think that's sort of what Messi puts you into sometimes, this stupor of just like, oh my God, I mean, what else are you supposed to do other than smile at that? Because it's ridiculous. I mean, it was a perfect free kick. It was the one spot where there was just absolutely nothing Alisson could do about it. And from quite a long way out as well.
Actually, the ball was moved about 5 or 8 yards further forward from where it was
taken. I was trying to
figure
that out this morning. I was looking at it again, and the free kick or the foul does appear to have taken place considerably further back than from where the free kick was taken. But I was looking at it from two different angles, so it's hard to be precise.
But is that perhaps taking something away?
I was rather hoping we could get through this discussion without nitpicking. I suppose now we're obliged to mention the fact that goalkeepers seem to think Alisson probably shouldn't have had a wall at all because it obstructed his view. And from that distance, that there's no need for one. But that was probably the best free kick I've ever seen. It was absolutely
It's not as
amazing.
Good as Roberto Carlos in the Tournois.
Roberto Carlos was a fluke. He has admitted that himself.
Juninho, Lyon's Juninho, has about 10 free kicks better than that.
About 10?
Yeah.
That's a big number, but I mean, I believe he has some.
Well, when I say it's the best free kick I've ever seen, what I basically mean is it's the most recent.
Can we think of any more superlatives, Paul? I mean, his close control when he's surrounded by so many players is just unbelievable. His ability to play a brilliant pass when he's surrounded by that many players.
Yeah. Messi leaves me a little cold, to be honest. Oh. I mean, he's obviously extremely and exceptionally good. Well, I much prefer watching Luis Suarez, for example, than Messi. There's something charmless and bloodless about him. He's like a laboratory creation. You know, he's obviously better than everyone else. It doesn't seem like he has to work for it. I like to see the effort going into it.
So you prefer Nadal to Federer in that sense?
you like to see the blood and guts.
Yeah, yeah. Or Ronaldo to Messi, or Best or Maradona to Messi. Not only because, obviously, the current situation in terms of pitch and not really allowed tackle properly. I would have been more impressed, for example, if Messi had produced goals like he did last night at Old Trafford after getting his chops bust by Chris Smalling, but he didn't.
I just think it's an interesting point to pick up because Milner, it felt like quite early in the game, tried to put one on him a little bit. Like Milner did sort of bowl him over and didn't pick up a yellow card for it. And it made me think about what happened against United and whether or not Liverpool were trying that. But they didn't seem to sort of stick with a particularly sort of, yeah, I don't know, aggressive physical approach on him necessarily.
Speaking of sort of laboratory creations, I was wondering if you built the perfect footballer out of, you know, say Salah's dribbling and Modric's short passing and, you know, you take the best control, etc. And you put them alongside Messi, who would be better? I sort of was thinking Messi is better than all the best bits of all the other footballers.
Yeah, he's not better in the air than Ronaldo, for
no.
example.
I knew heading would come in. I'm taking heading out of this.
Oh, I see.
Am I allowed to do that?
I think you could laboratory create something better than him. Ronaldo's very close to him in a sort of very different way of playing the game. And so you add a few things. I don't know, make Ronaldo, you know, even as fast as Ronaldo was a few years ago, or certainly, you know, as fast as Salah can be. I don't know. Like, there's ways you could make something that's even more extraordinary, I'm sure. And I'm certain, because this is the way sport has always gone, that in 50 years' time, if not sooner, there'll be another player who we're looking at and going, oh, this guy's the best ever, and he's even better than Messi was. So, that, you know, that's how these things tend to go. I do find, I mean, I'm not with Paul in as much as I think that Messi, for me, is the most extraordinary player I've watched in my lifetime. He's the one I find most sort of breathtaking, which is not to take away from some of the other guys you mentioned. But I will say that there are times when you look at him and he does things like this and you think, okay, but then why isn't that, why isn't that literally all the time? And I think, you know, again, if you want to talk about a game that could give Liverpool some hope in this tie, last season away at Roma, he wasn't there. You know, he was on the pitch for 90 minutes and he didn't actually influence the game at all, and they lost. And it obviously is just the reality of being human that you can't be on all the time. I suppose that maybe where I can, and I'm sure that they're easy enough to dig through Ronaldo's back catalogue and find games where he didn't show up. But I suppose that you feel like Ronaldo, even when he isn't making the mercurial things happen, he's always sort of physically aggressive and trying to be sort of involved in that way. Whereas with Messi, when he doesn't make the magic happen, perhaps he can be a bit more invisible. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. He's like a white collar player. When everything is perfect, perfectly set up for him, he is perfect. Yeah, he is an extraordinary player, as you said. But
Everything wasn't set up perfectly for him last night, and he scored two goals and basically put the tie beyond Liverpool.
No, what I mean by that is he's obviously blessed with much better balance than anyone else, much better control than anyone else, and he's got these gifts that have been bestowed on him, on which he uses absolutely exceptionally. But he doesn't do anything that doesn't appear to come naturally to him. It's like Theo Walcott, who's been blessed with extreme pace and made a great career out of that, but annoyed a lot of people because he never really added a hell of a lot else.
But he must try, you know, he practices so, free kicks, he trains.
It's a slight caricature I'm painting, obviously, but I'm just saying that's why he doesn't charm me as much as Luis Suarez does, for example.
Messi scored 6 goals versus the Premier League top 6 this season, which is more than any other player. 600 goals in 683 games. His first on the 1st of May 2005, exactly 14 years ago, assisted by Ronaldinho. He's played against 85 teams in all competitions, scored versus 76 of those teams. 368 more goals than any other Barcelona player. And his 600 is one more than the combined total of the goals scored by Liverpool's and Manchester United's top scorers. Ian Rush, 346, Wayne Rooney, 253, with a combined 1,219 games. To the game itself, Liverpool made Barcelona change their tactics, Barry. They went more defensive.
Yeah, at one stage, I think Philippe Coutinho was the first to go, get the hook, and he was replaced by another right back. So they basically had two right backs on the pitch. And I made the point in the minute-by-minute report, I did that, I don't know, was it 7 or 8 years ago? Andy Robertson was playing for Queen's Park in Scotland as a part-timer and working in a supermarket. And last night, Valverde was adjusting his tactics to try and cope with the damage he was doing at the first leg of a semi-final in Camp Nou in the Champions League. So that's quite a journey, and he's been on. I mean, Liverpool had a plan, and they stuck to it, and it worked to an extent. But as Mike Tyson says, everyone has a plan until they get a smack in the mouth, and they got three smacks in the mouth. They should have scored. They missed several excellent chances. But while their approach was commendable, and they weren't in any way cowed by Barcelona, and they forced Barcelona into making mistakes in the first half, and they dominated them early in the second half, I thought their decision-making in the final third was poor. I thought their crossing was diabolical, and I thought their set-piece delivery was diabolical, corners and stuff. And that's uncharacteristic for them. I can't explain why it was so bad. But they must feel very grieved at leaving without at least an away goal to their name. But then again, they could also have been 5-0 down because Barca had those 2 3-on-1s very close to the end of the game from Liverpool corners.
Paul? No, I just agree with that bit about their deliveries. That's why I was surprised that he didn't bring on Trent Alexander-Arnold for Gomez at some point, particularly during the period when they were dominant, because his precision from the right is generally a much better crosser, both from open play and set pieces, than Gomez.
Were you surprised he didn't start Alexander-Arnold? Because it's Gomez's first game for a long time.
Yeah, I can kind of understand that. Gomez is an exceptionally good player as well, so I can understand that. But the way the match panned out, I would have expected him to adjust and throw on Alexander-Arnold, which he didn't. About the second goal, I thought the second goal summed up the key difference between the sides. Just the way Suarez's shot that came off the crossbar, the way he improvised and shot very close to goal with his thigh. It was a brilliant piece of improvisation. And that level of sharpness was just what Liverpool were lacking at key moments through it. Sadio Mane, Salah at the end, Milner a couple of times. That ultimately was the key difference.
Suarez's run on the first goal is really nice as well. Exactly, you know, works out where he's going to confuse those two centre-backs and make them not sure who should be picking him up. I mean, you know, Barca are an extraordinary team. I think... You get into the detail of it, and I think the Gomez selection is interesting because you say Maxi hasn't started in months, and it's in one sense it's not surprising because Klopp has used him in these, you know, when he's had him available in these big games before, but he hadn't started in months, and arguably he's at fault on that first goal. And then the other sort of big decision, I suppose, tactically is putting Wijnaldum in that unfamiliar position, trying to support the attack, and he perhaps didn't have the best game. But I also had a lot of sympathy with Klopp. I mean, Klopp afterwards said that this was the best Champions League game we played not only this year or last year. Now, I think it might be a little bit of hyperbole in that. Obviously, last year they had a pretty good one at home to Man City, amongst others. But he said, play well.
Yeah, Klopp says, he said after that, no one will be interested in that but a few football nerds, which is surely where we are, right? Because it's about the result. But I can work really good with this game, is what he said. We understand what he means, obviously.
Yeah, I thought they played well. Like, I really did. Like, I thought they played well, and the game was decided by an opponent who, you know, collectively and then individually with Lionel Messi were more effective in taking chances and making, I suppose, the, you know, making quite such clear chances in a couple of moments as well. I don't think, you know, I don't think there's any shame in getting beaten away to Barcelona. I think it's definitely unfortunate for Liverpool that they did play well and they still come away with a 3-goal deficit, which is obviously a lot to make up.
One thing I should say, actually, because we don't really say very often about Barcelona, is there was some great last-ditch defending from the time, great throwing themselves in front of shots and stuff like that, which they don't have occasion to do very often.
That Salah miss, you think, is crucial, right? I mean,
any number of misses were crucial. James Milner's miss was crucial. Salah's miss was crucial. Sadio Mane's... I suppose Salah's was the worst of them, although you could argue that Milner's was pretty bad as well. Look, on any other night, they might score three, and that's just life, I suppose, that the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. I did find it quite funny that there seemed to be some frothing outrage on social media, which, you know, isn't a fair barometer of all Liverpool fans over the temerity of Luis Suarez to celebrate his goal. But what those people don't know is that in Uruguay, celebrating a goal against your former team is actually a sign of respect.
Kieran does say, will you do everything you can to get Suarez into your shithouse Gillingham 11 next season? Sid did a really good interview with him, didn't he, last week, and it painted a different picture of Suarez off the pitch to on the pitch. But
well, I imagine he is completely different off the pitch.
He said it.
He seems like a very nice guy, family man, good buddies with Leo Messi, and their kids play together, and, you know, but on the pitch he's a different animal and one you really love to have in your team. Liverpool fans had no problem with his antics when he was playing for them, but, you know, now he's gone elsewhere. Some of them, a minority, like the minority who were throwing, you know, passers-by into fountains and littering nice squares in Barcelona, they're not happy, are they?
No.
On that fountain thing, a pretty depressing video of that man throwing people he doesn't know into fountains. One of them was an Asian tourist. Fans were abusing him, calling him Mr. Miyagi. Liverpool have got some criticism for coming out in a statement criticising the actions of the guy, but not calling out the racism. Just incredibly. I don't know what you've meant to say, really.
Well, it's you know, Liverpool fans aren't the first to misbehave in Europe, and they won't be the last. And we've seen it recently. You know, Leicester as well. Take your pick. I just don't understand why English football fans can't visit a foreign city. They have to occupy it.
Mm.
And I don't get it.
That happens with England as well, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't happen with other countries' fans, as far as I can tell. You know, I don't mean congregate in one place, drink beer and have fun. I mean, occupy, you know, put up flags. This is our territory now, and be incredibly obnoxious to locals. You know, you wouldn't do it if you're going to visit someone's house. Don't do it when you're going to visit someone else's country.
Hmm. No, well said. Liverpool go away to Newcastle on Saturday night. I was chatting to a Liverpool fan earlier this week saying, Newcastle away on a Saturday night is a different prospect to Newcastle away on an early kickoff. You just feel, you know, Rafa's there, St James's will be buzzing on Saturday night, and you could just sort of see this season Liverpool being so, so close and so brilliant in two competitions and coming out with nothing.
Could you imagine
Barry for the tape, two fingers crossed. You're such a bastard, aren't you? Paolo, carry
on. I'm trying to imagine Rafa celebrating a Newcastle win the same way Suarez celebrated that goal. I'm not quite sure that would be his reaction. I imagine he wants Liverpool to win, doesn't he? I mean, he doesn't want them to win this game. He's, I'm sure, going to do his best to make sure Newcastle win the game. But I think he's still got a lot of love for Liverpool, hasn't he?
Well, Rafa's normal approach then would be, knowing how much the match means to Liverpool, would be to set out to frustrate them, keep it nil-nil for as long as possible. There's a school of thought that because of his affection to Liverpool, he won't do that, and he'll just go gung-ho and say, well, I wanted to entertain the home fans.
Yeah, that'd be interesting if he does.
Yeah, either way, it'll be totally fascinating to see, won't it? And that game is 2 days before Manchester City host Leicester, so Liverpool really need to pick themselves up. That'll do for part one. In part two, we will discuss Ajax's win at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the 10th of May, next Friday, at Earth in Hackney, me, you, Barry, Jonathan Wilson, and Lars Sivertsen, and now announcing, is this official, producer Jonathan? Just been written in. Ellis James joins us as well. So that should shift the rest of the tickets, shouldn't it? Good news. I'm looking forward to it tremendously. He's good, Ellis, isn't he?
Yes, I'm a big fan of his work. Mm.
Who's your favourite, me or Ellis?
In what way?
Well, you can interpret the question however you like.
As in,
Who would you most like to be stuck in a lift with for 3 hours?
Ellis.
Who would you most like to go on holiday with?
Ellis.
Who would you most like to have a couple of pints with?
Ellis.
Who would you most like to work with on a regular basis?
You.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Tottenham 0, Ajax 1. I was there quite high up, and I bumped into a friend just outside the toilet after 20 minutes, and he said, well, half time I bumped into him, and he said after 20 minutes he had to count how many players Ajax had just to check that they only had 11. Look, we've seen Ajax outplay Real at the Bernabeu, Juve in Turin. So, Paolo, should we be surprised that Ajax did this in the first half? And in many ways, Tottenham did better than Real Madrid and Juventus did.
Yeah, and I was I was really looking forward to this game. I'm really looking forward to second leg. I thought that what happened with both Real Madrid and Juventus at times was that it just seemed like they were not playing with the same degree of pace and I mean sort of speed of feet, but also speed of thought as Ajax. And I thought, wow. Surely this is something Tottenham are equipped for. Tottenham are a fast team. They are a physical team. They'll be a bit more sort of equipped for that. And they started as if they weren't. And of course, we then had this weird situation where Vertonghen goes off and gets hurt. And perhaps after that, Tottenham did wake up to the pace of the game. And I think we're a lot better after that. But for the first half an hour, it was exactly the same story as we've seen, yes, against Madrid and against Juventus, where it was just one team that looked like it was on a completely different frame rate almost to the team they're up against, and you know, notionally the underdog, although I actually think that the betting odds had moved perhaps even in Ajax's favour before kickoff, because people have started to wake up to how good they are, and some of the football in the first 20 minutes, half an hour was exceptional. I mean, I just saw a stat earlier today. Ajax made 132 accurate passes in the first 15 minutes to Spurs' 43. I mean, it's, you know, it's like a non-game happening. It was so one-sided. And in that regard, yeah, I guess Tottenham can look at it and go, well, we did all right to come away only one goal down. You know, we've just been talking about Liverpool and going away to Madrid and playing well and not getting a result. Maybe Ajax feel that they should have got even more out of that opening period, because some of the football was devastating. But at the same time, this is your home leg in the Champions League. And while we can talk about bookies odds or whatnot, I mean, Tottenham are a vastly better resourced club than Ajax in terms of their finances, and I think a lot of people will have looked at Juventus going out and thought this is a big opportunity to get to Champions League final. So not ideal on that point of view, but yeah, I'd say the tie is very much alive. And especially, I mean, the key thing for me is Son. Like, I just think that Tottenham are going to look so different with him in the second leg, because they were really lacking that ability to stretch Ajax when they came back into the game.
And it looks to me that the Ajax, because they play out from the back so well, when you've got Llorente, right, he can't press, right? He literally can't do it. So they play those passes along the ground back through to their centre midfielders who have space. And if you are being pressed by Son, that's a totally different thing, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. Tottenham collectively misfired. They didn't look like a collective. I mean, compared to the fluency of Ajax, it was like a team against a very disjointed rabble for long periods. And that was partly because of the absences from Spurs, and also the fact that some of their big players just didn't perform. I mean, Eriksen had a shocker. Mm. I thought he mislaid so many passes, and Dele Alli was barely involved. So if those two can perform better in the second leg and with Song back, then there is a greater chance of them having more cohesion, you would think. And maybe even if Harry Kane is back, although that does sound like a rather desperate measure, I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, with those rumours have started, haven't they? Did Pochettino get it wrong, Barry, by playing three at the back? I mean, he was forced into the change because of what happened to Vertonghen.
Well, I think he said after the game it was his mistake. He got the system wrong. And Graham Souness made a point on Irish television, for which he has been widely pilloried, saying that he basically said he was fed up with people obsessing about tactics and formations, and that unless you're first to the ball, you know, tactics, formation don't matter. And some people have interpreted this to mean that he's saying tactics and formations are irrelevant. There's no place for them in the game. And my interpretation of what he said was, you can have these brilliant plans and tactics, but unless your players are up for it and playing energetically, which Tottenham's weren't in the first 25 minutes, then those plans are useless.
My interpretation was like, I can stop reading Inverting the Pyramid. I was pleased about that, Paolo.
Well, I don't fully agree with the Sooners. I do think that it is astonishing if you watch now these three knockout ties, and indeed you go back to group stage and see the same thing. Ajax have made everyone look sluggish. That's the point. Like, they just make, teams that we, think of and are the biggest sort of wealthiest, most successful teams in Europe, they've made them look like they're playing too slow. And that was, again, the thing which I sort of expected to be a bit different with Tottenham, because, cliche though it is, it is still true that the Premier League games are often played at a higher tempo than they are in some other leagues. They are a team that, even within that context, within the context of the Premier League, are capable of playing at very high tempo. And so it was very striking to see Spurs look that sluggish to me. But I think that, that is...
How are Ajax doing that?
But that's it. At a certain point, when it's been this many teams in a row, you have to stop saying, well, it's just that team being sluggish. Say, well, it's Ajax are making them look like that. It's not just they're doing it. Look, something specific. I was just saying quickly, Ajax did have the weekend off, which they won't have for the second leg. And that matters, I think, at this stage of the season.
But yeah, it's just about their passing and movement. It's about keeping the ball away from the opponents so that they end up looking sluggish because they're trying to chase it, but they can't get close enough to it.
But are they doing something that no one else... I mean, I just can't. Well, a lot of teams do this so well.
They're doing it better. It's a triumph of coaching and picking players with exactly the right skill set for the particular roles they play.
Several of the players don't seem to have any particular brief from the manager. They just go and play, do what you want. And they seem to be so finely tuned into what each other is doing or going to do or about to do, that it just works. Actually, it'd be interesting to see when that team breaks up, which it widely predicted it will, how they fare at other clubs when they're no longer at Ajax.
You're right, because actually watching it in the ground, you could see times where a player would get the ball and would play a ball without looking into a space, and you'd imagine a Tottenham team would press that and get those advantages, but there was always an Ajax man there. We should get on to the Vertonghen thing, right? He got a head injury. Apparently, he wasn't concussed. They did all the checks. He was allowed back onto the field and almost collapsed. Barry, your high horse.
How do we know they did all the checks?
They've said they did all the checks.
Right.
Now, actually, before you get
then
on...
Then they must have done all the checks.
Well, actually, it's interesting. Headway, who are a brain injury charity, say there need to be temporary substitutions now because they say a reliable diagnosis cannot be made on the pitch because the pressure is enormous and unfair, particularly in high-stakes games like this. Isn't the time.
I saw them wipe blood off his nose. Is that a check for concussion? Cleaning his a bloody nose? I didn't see him do much else.
I mean, that isn't a check, is it?
No, it isn't.
Got a nosebleed. And he's not going to play on Saturday against Bournemouth. He's seeing a neurologist today.
Well, he shouldn't play on Saturday, in my opinion. This has been going on for years, and it's clearly not going to change until someone dies. Football clubs, and I'm not specifically levelling this at Tottenham, but we know that football clubs, management teams cannot be trusted to let their doctors or tell their doctors to do the right thing. We had the case at Chelsea where Dr. Eva Carneiro was basically demoted and more or less constructively dismissed because she refused an order from Jose Mourinho and did her job instead that she's, obliged as a doctor to do. So we need independent physicians there to conduct these tests. And if that means a player going off for 5 minutes and a sub coming on in his place, then so be it.
Yeah, I think it's a really... it is a challenging dilemma for football, right? Because that five-minute substitute thing, in spirit, I totally agree with. And I also understand the argument that you go on for 5 minutes when you're rushed in and then you go off again, and then maybe if you come back on again afterwards, when your muscles get cold, like that can lead to injuries of a different kind, less serious injuries than a head injury, but it can still be a difficult thing to manage coming on and off in and out of a football game like that. I do think that without question in my mind, it has to go to independent doctors. And I think this is it's not even a question of deliberate things necessarily. We can talk about what happened at Chelsea, but even just sort of the simple, complicated nature of personal relationships, the fact that these doctors are working with players every day, they know how much it matters to them to be involved in a certain game. They have, you know, friendships and everything. I think that even if you, with the best will in the world, you don't want those things to influence your decision, it will. And I think you need someone who's completely emotionally detached from the situation to look at it and go, and maybe an independent doctor would have made exactly the same judgment on Vertonghen. Maybe for whatever reason, for a minute, he was really cogent and was able to convince the doctor that it was, that he was fine when actually he wasn't. And it's not, you know, saying this doesn't mean that the Tottenham doctors acted in bad faith or anything like that, but I think you have to, for the sake of safety, put that in the hands of someone who is not emotionally related in any way or involved with the team. It's what the NFL did. Now, the NFL does have the luxury of, because it's a slow game, because you have rolling subs anyway all the time, of taking people aside and having a full 10, 15 minutes or whatever you need to make that assessment. Maybe football needs to think about how long it takes as well, but I saw something off the back of this that FIFA still are opposed to the use of independent doctors, and I just don't get it. I just don't understand why anyone would have a problem with this decision being taken out of clubs' hands, because it seems so obvious to me that they cannot be the most responsible parties here.
A Spurs statement published yesterday, Vertonghen was assessed on the pitch immediately after the incident with our medical team strictly following FA concussion guidelines. Following testing, he was judged to be alert and answered all questions correctly and lucidly, deeming him fit to return to the field of play. All available video footage was relayed to our on-pitch medical team and they were able to confirm he had suffered no loss of consciousness. Jan was immediately withdrawn as a result of the player informing medical staff that symptoms were developing suddenly and he no longer felt stable standing up. Tests today have been clear and testing will continue for the next few days. Additionally, as is standard club policy with certain injuries, we shall also be seeking independent advice. Jan is due to see a neurologist who specialises in elite athletes today. The player has reported no ill effects. Now, Spurs go to Bournemouth on Saturday. It's the early kickoff. A win guarantees them top four in Champions League football. You get the feeling with Spurs that some of their players are turning up going, not another football match. I know that's what they're there to do, but I suppose, it's a stupid thing to say. It could go one of two ways at the end of this season, couldn't it? They win on Saturday and they could get something in Amsterdam and it's a glorious season, or it could be a disaster, right?
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see what team he picks. I mean, there must be a strong temptation to just field the youth players, because they may never get a better chance to reach the Champions League final as a club and Pochettino as a manager. And their playing resources are already stretched, so I'd say there's got to be a strong case for doing that.
Mm. True, but Bournemouth are...
Especially as you can probably bank on at least two of the teams competing for the top four to fall apart.
Well, I mean, I think for Tottenham not to make the top four now, at a minimum, I think Arsenal would need to win both of their remaining games, which feels like a stretch the way they're playing. But I did see this that I hadn't picked up on tonight. Maybe everyone else did, but Tottenham have... Their only away win since the 20th of January is away to Dortmund. They've had one, two, three, they've had nine away games that time, and they've lost eight of them. The only one which they won was away to Dortmund. So that's pretty bad, their away form. I mean, they've played some tough games in that time. They've played Chelsea twice, City twice, but still. It would be alarming if it weren't, as Paul says, for the fact that no one behind them is going to... I think they could probably get no points in the remaining two games and still be in the top four at the end of the season.
Yeah. I mean, Bournemouth are decent at home, but... interestingly, actually, Ajax haven't been that clever at home in the Champions League either, which I suppose would give Tottenham hope. But yeah, they could probably chance spinning that one off again. I mean,
they've got Everton on the last day.
What do you? They're in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Why would you harm your chances of advancing to the final just to get into the group stages of next season's Champions League? It seems ridiculous.
It does seem ridiculous.
Especially if Pochettino kind of hinted that one of the reasons for Ajax's superiority was because they were much more fresh. Now, Ajax have the Dutch Cup final this
weekend. On Sunday, isn't it, as well, yeah.
So they're not going to be taking that lightly. So this is a chance for Spurs to totally turn the tables.
Off the pitch, nine fans were arrested, three police officers injured after clashes between Spurs and Ajax supporters before... and after the game, which is pretty disappointing, isn't it? Europa League, we touched on it briefly earlier. Tonight, Arsenal host Valencia. Chelsea go to Eintracht Frankfurt. What do you reckon, Paolo?
I reckon that Arsenal are very much hoping that the Europa League performance, any good ones we've seen from them lately, that they'll find another one of those. Won't get to see former Arsenal, I think legend's the appropriate word, Coquelin, back at the Emirates because he's suspended, sadly. But no, I mean, look, Arsenal have been very confident at home in the Europa League this season. They haven't shown much good anywhere in the most recent games. But yeah, if they can tap back into whatever Unai Emery Europa League magic that he has, they can get through this. Yeah, I don't know what's that. I think Aaron Ramsey's really badly missed.
He's played his last game for Arsenal now.
Yes, and he won't play again now. And I think that's sort of been glaringly obvious since he went out, is quite how significant a player Arsenal have let go of. But, you know, it's hard to talk about this team at the moment without bringing it back to what an absolute state the defence is. I mean, Mustafi gets singled out and you know, justifiably, because some of the things he's been doing lately, it's hard to square with a World Cup winner, someone who's played top-level football for a long time, but he's hardly the only one. The whole defence is a mess.
World Cup winner is kind of a slightly devalued term, though.
They always say about Fernando Llorente, don't they?
Yeah, but even guys who played a big role in the World Cup, like Paul Pogba, or Mesut Ozil is a World Cup winner as well. That's no longer the barometer of a world-class player, which sounds a ridiculous thing to say, because club football is a more accurate indicator of a player's ability.
In the Football League, in midweek, Bristol City won at Millwall. Derby were held at Swansea. Millwall were one up and missed a penalty before Bristol City scored two late goals. That means the final playoff place, the only thing still to be decided on the last day in the Championship. Derby are in the box seat. They've got 71 points. They host West Brom, who are in fourth. West Brom, if they win, can leapfrog Leeds if they lose to Ipswich. There was a lovely video of Bielsa trying to say Ipswich lots of times, then saying, I give up. If Derby fail to win, a Middlesbrough victory at relegated Rotherham gets them in the playoffs. If Derby lose and Middlesbrough fail to win, Bristol City can sneak in. They go to Hull. Hull, of course, stopped them getting promoted with that Dean Windass volley, didn't they? All those years ago. In Bolton news, their final game of the season at Nottingham Forest will go ahead on Sunday before their penultimate game of the season against Brentford, after the club said the players would be available. The game was in doubt after last week's game was postponed. Bolton players went on strike over unpaid wages for March and April. According to the BBC, the PFA have agreed to loan the club money to cover some of the unpaid wages. Lawrence Bassini still trying to buy the club from Ken Anderson. It's pretty acrimonious between the two of them. The EFL are meeting today about when to play that game against Brentford. It's a very disappointing situation. And I spoke to the players' representative, Andy Taylor, about their decision to go on strike. And what you got from him was just the absolute complete lack of communication from anyone, from Ken Anderson, from the EFL. You know, they haven't been paid for 2 months. Very difficult decision for them to take, and not really knowing what the implications would be of, say, Bolton not fulfilling their fixtures. Would that mean a points deduction? Would that mean being thrown out of the league altogether? No one seemed to know. The EFL didn't know. Maybe they're meeting today about that. But
well, the EFL couldn't find their arse with both hands. I mean, they're an absolute joke of an organisation. Their head, well, soon to be outgoing head, he's been involved with at least two different clubs that went into administration, and he's in charge of the Football League. So he doesn't seem like a fit and proper person to be in charge of the EFL, and they're in charge of judging who's fit and proper to be in charge of a football club, and they're clearly incapable of doing that properly. So, you know, is it a surprise that this is a complete shambles?
I suppose if you're playing devil's advocate, you can't. The EFL have got to be strong, haven't they, against Bolton going on strike? Because if you take the,
it's a pretty good grounds for going on strike, isn't it? Not getting paid.
No. I totally agree. But the point being, if you don't want you don't want any football club to go out of business. You don't want them to be thrown out of the league, of course, because we're all football fans, and you can see it could happen to your club if you have the wrong owners. But if, in the same way that Northern Rock got bailed out, right? If every football club gets bailed out, then the league, whether it's the Premier League or the EFL or whoever, if they don't act strongly,
well, the EFL shouldn't have let it come to this. The EFL shouldn't have let what's his name?
Anderson.
Anderson being the owner of Bolton in the first place. And then when it became apparent that players weren't being paid on time, they should have intervened and ensured they were paid on time. And if that didn't happen then, they should have sanctioned Anderson. So why do they wait until the players announce that they're going on strike to take action and then try and get the under-18s in a scab labour to cross a picket line? It's a ridiculous way to run a governing body.
Yeah, true. And actually, on the Tuesday, they announced they would have an emergency meeting. The Tuesday was when the Brentford game was announced it was going to be postponed, and the EFL said, we'll have an emergency meeting on Thursday. And you were like, shouldn't you have an emergency meeting now?
Yeah. We will schedule an emergency meeting for 3 weeks' time.
Elsewhere, Leeds' Patrick Bamford facing a two-game ban after being charged with successful deception of a match official by the FA after he went to the floor clutching his face in the aftermath of that goal when the ball wasn't booted out. Leeds didn't boot the ball out. Anwar El Ghazi was sent off. That red card has been rescinded. Jamie says, shambles Bamford getting a ban for that. Just another example of the Tory government not supporting the arts. Bamford could miss the first leg of the playoff semi-finals. El Ghazi will be available for Villa, and they could still face each other in those semi-finals. He shouldn't have done it, should he? Although, did you see doing the rounds was a goal that Aston Villa scored against Stoke this season, where it might have been in the cup, but a Stoke player went down injured and Aston Villa attacked down that side with a Stoke player lying on the floor and Jonathan Codger scoring a header. And at no point did they let Stoke walk one in. Anyway.
Do as we say, not as we do.
In League One, disastrous news. Luton are promoted, as are Barnsley. Well done to Barnsley. That's because both Sunderland and Portsmouth lost. Even worse, Portsmouth got to Peterborough, which means Peterborough could still get in the playoffs. Portsmouth were 2-0 down. They got it back to 2-2. With quarter an hour left, they scored what looked like a winner, which was ruled out for offside. Total criminal. Ball squared across the box and the striker had just gone offside. A minute later, Peterborough got up the other end and score. Sunderland lost 2-1 at Fleetwood. They're resigned to the playoffs. But Lee Catamol scored a goal, so that's nice, Barry, isn't it?
He scored quite a few goals this season.
7, I think.
I have no confidence whatsoever of Sunderland getting out of those playoffs.
Okay. 7 None. Goals, 13 yellows, I believe, for Lee. Portsmouth, Sunderland, Charlton, all in the playoffs. Whatever happens in the games that they play will determine where they finish. Final playoff spot will be either Doncaster or Peterborough. Doncaster in the driving seat, thankfully. At the bottom, Bradford, the only team down ahead of the final fixtures. 3 of Wimbledon, Southend, Plymouth, Walsall and Scunthorpe will join them. In League Two, Bury got promoted by drawing with Tranmere Rovers, who sealed a playoff spot with that result. Mansfield and MK Dons in third and fourth, both 2 points behind Bury, play each other on Saturday in what is a straight shootout for the final automatic promotion spot. I like it when it's football in the sun and players crumple to the floor or run around in celebration at full time. Newport moved into...
The Milton Keynes ultras are clearly up for it because... the match is at Milton Keynes,
right?
And they've made 1,000 extra tickets available to the opposition.
Really?
Yeah. And it's interesting because MK Dons need to win to leapfrog Mansfield. If they don't, they could go into the playoffs where they could face Exeter City, with whom Paul Tisdale, the MK Dons manager, lost in the playoff final the last 2 years. Oh. So it could be a situation whereby either they're going to inflict further heartache on him or he's going to inflict further heartache on them.
Oh, good stuff. Newport moved into seventh. They're in the driving seat to get the final playoff spot. Lots of driving seats currently ahead of the last day.
Go with a box seat.
Okay. They can confirm with a win at Morecambe. At the bottom, Yeovil already down. So it is Macclesfield Town or Notts County who'll join them. Notts County need a miracle, really. They're 2 points behind Macclesfield, and Macclesfield are playing Cambridge United. So they really do. They got an inferior goal difference. So Macclesfield really do need just a point to survive.
What a job Saul Campbell has done there. Because they were, I think, 5 points adrift when he took over, and they were very much in a downward spiral. In fact, under the manager that they started the season with, they didn't win a single match. And under Campbell, I think they've taken points in 17 of 24 matches or something. It's a remarkable job.
It is.
Because a lot of people were just waiting for them to fail.
No,
I was one of them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So do we want Sol Campbell to stay up, or do we want Notts County, one of the originators of football, to survive.
May the best team win.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm happy with that. Paolo, what are you doing?
I'm looking at the League Two tables because it's not something that I often have close attention on.
Exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I spend a lot of time looking at that. Hoonagay says, not a question as such. I'd appreciate it if you could raise awareness of the horrific plight of the conference side, Gateshead, on the next Football Weekly. Gateshead, who actually Cambridge beat in 2015 to get in to the Football League in the playoffs. The club's been run into the ground by absent owners with club staff, the manager players being sacked by text and email. They ended the season with just 14 senior outfield players. Lots of players and staff out of contract or leaving the club. They now have only 4 employees. So we wish the best of luck to Gateshead. Hope you get out of that mess. An email from Ryan Ferguson with an interesting stat. He writes, Fitbar, I support Dunfermline Athletic. We currently play in the Scottish Championship and have had an atrocious season, even by our standards. One key stat that really stands out for me when looking at the top goal scorer at our home ground this season, 3 of our players have 3 goals each at home, but the top scorer at East End Park this season is Alan Troughton with 4, and he doesn't even play for us. What's even worse is he plays for Alloa, who are currently in the relegation playoff place. Along with our wish for success for Gateshead, we hope you turn it around at Dunfermline Athletic.
Think about Dunfermline, right? I'm reading an Ian Rankin rebus novel at the moment.
Okay.
Dunfermline get a name check in the book where a suspected goon in an abduction, a kid says, oh, that he was wearing a Paris shirt, Paris or Dunfermline. And just to add insult to this man's injury, it turns out it wasn't a Dunfermline shirt. It was a Newcastle shirt, black and white stripes.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League games and we'll do a bit of MLS too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hey, Barry, you remember we did that bit a week ago saying that the Guardian Football Weekly listeners were the most loyal, yet the tightest, because they didn't donate any money to the Guardian.
Yep.
Well, turns out we were wrong.
Well, I don't think we were. I think we just shamed them into
to
putting their hands in their pockets.
Lots of you did, and we really appreciate
yes.
it.
Yes.
I shouldn't sound so surprised at how generous you are, person walking down the street listening to this. Contributions from all over the world, Barry. Estonia, Japan, Finland, New Zealand, India, Israel. 2 from Malta. Thank you to the 2 people in Malta.
I reckon I know one of them.
Do you?
Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, Eddie, and the other person in Malta. Lots of you, interestingly, donating via your smartphones, which is apparently unusual for Guardian contributions. I like the breakdown. Laptops, also quite popular. People listening on tablets, absolute, complete tight asses. You know, if you've got a tablet, you're not interested in giving us money. If anyone didn't give money but now feels guilty because other people have given money, you can join the club and become a supporter. gu.com/footballweeklypod. Make us the most generous of all the pods. And then at the end of season pod review, we can look down at Today in Focus and Science Weekly and all the other ones. Right, Premier League this weekend. West Ham, Southampton. West Ham sent a request to the Premier League to bring this game forward to an early kickoff so that fans could also attend the Women's FA Cup final, which kicks off at 5:30. Premier League turned down that request. I guess Tottenham had also requested the early kickoff because they were on Monday night and they're playing in the Champions League. This game will finish 30 minutes before the final kicks off. Not enough time to get from Stratford to Wembley, although it is on the Jubilee line. So,
my understanding is the Premier League turned down the request because it would affect the travel plans of any Southampton fans who'd already booked tickets to go to West Ham.
Okay, fair enough.
I heard this from a fellow I know who wants to, him and his granddaughter go, are season ticket holders at West Ham, but they also want to go to the cup final, so they're going to the cup final. Seems like a ridiculous decision, and but not surprising. Mm. It smacks of willful sabotage to me.
I think quite a lot of West Ham fans are going to leave at half time. I've heard that.
Right.
And then pootle off to Wembley.
My understanding also is that Southampton had absolutely no problem whatsoever with switching the fixture, but
Dawn Butler, MP for Brent Central, where Wembley's located, wrote a letter expressing her disappointment. Premier League matches are routinely rearranged at short notice for TV purposes or competing scheduling reasons. I'm concerned that women's football still does not appear to be treated as seriously as men's football, and the priority appears to be to minimise disruption to the league game rather than the women's FA Cup final, one of the biggest occasions in the football calendar.
But you can kind of understand why would the Premier League want to promote a rival product?
Well, I mean, I understand that. It's also true that you're talking about a club that is one of your members that is making a request because that's also part of its interest. So, you know, does the league represent its clubs or do the clubs serve the league? You know, there's a...
I think we all know the answer to that one, pal.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I actually went to the Arsenal women's game against Brighton where they won the league down in Brighton. And that also, I mean, it's a bit of a less sort of, I suppose it's probably a bit less relevant because people who are trying to get to both those games be going from Leicester to Brighton, which is a lot further than from Stratford to Wembley. But those were put on at the same time as well, which I found odd at the time. But there you go.
Manchester City, enormous favourites for the cup final, 5-1 on. They faced each other twice this season. City have won both, scoring 10, conceding just 2 in that time. Man City women also just lost one game all season against Atletico Madrid in the Champions League back in September. While we're on women's football, Tottenham drew 1-1 at Aston Villa yesterday, confirming their promotion to the Women's Super League. They'll go up behind Manchester United, who were confirmed as champions 2 weeks ago. Cardiff City, Crystal Palace. Cardiff need to win to have any chance of staying up. 4 points behind Brighton with a much worse goal difference. There'd need to be a 14-goal swing to overcome the differences, which appears slightly unlikely. Neil Warnock fined $20,000 for those comments he made about Premier League officials after the Chelsea game where Aspilicueta scored that offside goal and Craig Pawson was the ref. And at the end of the game, Warnock walked on and just stared at him. Which seemed quite Game of Thrones to me, Barry. Not that I've ever seen it, but I imagine there are lots of people walking up and staring at people in Game of Thrones.
There's quite a bit of looking.
Is there?
Yeah.
Moody staring.
Bits, yeah.
Mm. There's more fornication.
It would have been more Game of Thrones-esque if Neil Warnock had sliced his head off with a broadsword.
Oh, okay. And then sort of fornicated with a serf.
Yeah. That,
okay, right. Anyway, he didn't do that. But look, he made comments in a post-match interview with the BBC, a post-match interview with Sky Sports, and an interview with me on TalkSport that have got him in trouble.
Do you feel guilty?
Interestingly, it was the first thing he said was, I went home and I said to my wife, I should have, you know, she wouldn't have minded if I'd bashed the ref. And he said it in a... He said it in a sort of laughing way, but it was a dumb thing to say given referees getting abused off the pitch. And I probably should have picked him up on it straight away, but when it's the first thing someone said and you're thinking he's a Premier League manager who doesn't have to come on, I'll get into it later.
Are you saying you were kowtowing to Neil Warnock?
I did ask him if he feels... Because he had a massive go at the fourth official in that game, and I did ask him how he feels looking back at that. But he told me I tried to compare it to how I behave on a pitch, and he said you couldn't compare the Premier League to Saturday afternoon not amateur football, which is probably fair enough. But yeah, I should have picked him up on it, to be fair. Newcastle-Liverpool is the late kickoff on Saturday. As we discussed, Man City-Leicester's on Monday. Top four Super Sunday, everybody. After the Spurs game on the early Saturday kickoff, they'll know a bit more on what they need to do. Chelsea-Watford. Huddersfield v Manchester United. Presumably this is the time where these sides start to win. Arsenal have played Brighton as well. I mean, you'd imagine they've got to win those games, right?
You'd imagine, wouldn't you? But then what evidence have we got from any of these teams recently that they are going to do what we imagine? I mean, Chelsea against Watford, you certainly think Chelsea should win that. They are missing... Rudiger now for the rest of the season after he had knee surgery. Troy Deeney's back from his suspension for Watford. But still, yeah, you think Chelsea at home should win that. But then how many other games recently could we have looked at and said, well, Chelsea should win that, and then they didn't? Chelsea, you know, I think most people thought they'd beat Burnley at home, and they didn't. So who knows? Likewise, Arsenal-Brighton. Well, yeah, sure, they're at home, so it's not the terrible away form, but Arsenal were supposed to beat Crystal Palace at home as well, weren't they? So conceded, yeah, 9 goals in the last 3 league games. I don't feel a great deal of faith in any of these teams to win games. But I sort of suspect that Chelsea will be still fourth at the end of it all by inertia, if nothing else.
Huddersfield United. James says, would a team of John O'Shea's do better than the current United team? John O'Shea's confirmed he'll retire at the end of the season. He's currently at Reading, played 250 times, just over 250 times for Manchester United. Won 118 caps for the Republic of Ireland before he retired in June. A great servant to your homeland, Paul?
Yes, he was. I'm struggling to think of anything to say about John O'Shea.
He's slightly pilloried in a sort of Phil Jones, Chris Smalling way. And
No, he's better than that.
And he shouldn't be.
He was always very reliable for club and country. Even famously filling in as a goalkeeper for United once. No, he did. He got the best out of himself. He had a tremendous career. Well done.
Barry, you happy with that?
Yep.
Okay. A slightly more depressing story from Irish football. James McLean posting to Twitter a card he received in the post, which someone had written in it, happy birthday and die, as well as anti-Irish racism. Kick it out. Wrote, we reiterate our stance, which we previously made clear. Sectarian abuse is discriminatory, should be dealt with accordingly. It has no place in football. Kick it out has been in continuous contact with Stoke City on this issue, have offered our support to James McLean. The vicious treatment he continues to receive is a disgrace and brings shame upon the sport. On Twitter yesterday, Paul, there was a fair bit saying kick it out and the authorities do much less with anti-Irish racism or bigotry than they do with other forms of that. Would you, I'm not just asking you because you're Irish, I've got a choice here, but is that something you think is valid?
I think what's certainly true is James McLean gets sectarian abuse at a lot of the matches he plays in, and I'm not aware of a huge amount being done to stop it. Have people been dragged out or whatever? And it's been going on a long time. I don't know what the football authorities can do about a guy sending something through the mail, but this particular letter does seem like something that the police might like to be aware of.
We've talked about the whole Poppy thing before and how, you know, David Squires and Marina Hyde have brilliantly exposed how utterly ridiculous it is that people shout at him for not doing something that is he has legitimate reasons for doing, right? And that seems to be where this abuse originates from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he gets far worse abuse than a birthday card sent by some clown through the post, although that does show an extraordinary level of dedication on the part of that clown, you know, when there are so many other easy ways of abusing McLean. But he gets it purely because he refuses to wear the poppy. I don't think it's particularly because he's Irish. He doesn't wear the poppy because he's Irish and he's from a nationalist area of Derry, and he has his own very valid reasons for doing it, and a lot of people either are too stupid to understand those reasons or just willfully refuse to accept them, I suppose. But he gets a lot worse than, you know, birthday cards with nasty sentiments written on them. The only place for them is the bin.
Really sad news about the Czech Republic international. Josef Sorel died after a minibus carrying the Alanya Spor team back from an away game crashed. The bus, Stephen Caulker was also in the bus, former Newcastle striker as well. Papis Cisse, four more of Sorel's teammates. Turkish police have detained the driver of the bus, with the Alanya Spor chairman claiming he was told by police that both the driver and the backup driver were asleep. They were just 3 miles away from the end of their 350-mile journey. Iker Casillas is recovering in hospital after suffering a heart attack while training with Porto yesterday. Porto said in a statement, Casillas is okay, stable, and the heart problem has been resolved. He sent a picture on Twitter in a hospital bed with his thumbs up. I think always kind of shocking news when someone you perceive to be so fit, I mean, it's happened to footballers before, hasn't it, Paolo? But when you see someone like that, you think, well, it sort of defies your logic.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, a younger man and likewise perceived to be in the peak of health, David Astori, passed away in Italy just very recently. So it is always shocking when it happens. And I think, from my perspective, the only real thought here is just a great deal of relief that he seems to be okay on the other side of it.
Absolutely. In MLS, did everybody watch Zlatan Ibrahimovic versus Nader Manua, which is not a contest I thought would be quite as spicy as it turned out to be. Zlatan was trash-talking Anua all through the game, scored the winner. Nadim said he came in to apologise after the game because from 60 minutes in, he's saying he's going to do me, he's going to hurt me for that game. This is a guy who's the face of MLS, as he calls himself. This is the way he plays on the field. I don't care. If someone comes in and says that to me, I don't care. I'm not going to accept his apology. It's unacceptable. Zlatan says, what happens on the field stays on the field. I like to feel alive. I like it when it becomes duels and that, because sometimes, not that I fall asleep, but I don't feel alive if they don't activate me. They need to activate me or else it becomes too easy. I know me. When I get angry, I feel good.
I find this like really interesting, and you know, it put me in mind of what Neil Warnock said to you earlier about you can't compare your sort of weekend amateur experience to playing professional football. But because I feel like I've definitely encountered this playing even, you know, five-a-side leagues on a weeknight. You get some people who you play against, if you play in those leagues, who seem to arrive angry mm-hmm. and want to be angry for their entire experience, which I've never understood. Because for me, I'm playing a social sport of an evening with my friends and I want to be happy and have a nice time.
I gave up playing five-a-side because of a bloke like that.
Yeah.
Because it just really made the whole experience miserable. Because if you were on his team, he was one of those guys stood in the middle pointing and giving out to you for not doing things that he wasn't doing either. And if you were against him, he'd just foul you and snarl and get in.
Yeah.
Found the whole experience thoroughly unpleasant.
It's very odd. Like, some people seem to really like want to like use that space to get their like, I don't know, their physical aggression out. Which, of course, again, maybe completely different. Professional footballer Zlatan has been very successful for a long time. Maybe he needs that to be as successful as he is. But I've never got it, certainly in the amateur.
I mean, I suppose Nadim can't just stop. It's his profession. Slightly different. Finally, Keith asks, which TV detective would be your first choice to find out who murdered John Higgins at the Crucible? Have you seen this clip? It's absolutely tremendous clip of the snooker where someone else, I don't know, is just potting, is lining up a red, and John Higgins.
Neil Robertson, I think.
Right, and John Higgins is having a little nap, but it does look like he's been killed and he's there for 25 seconds. I would go Angela Lansbury.
I'd probably go Poirot or Marple just for the big reveal when they gather everyone round.
Mm.
Or indeed Arlo Hanlon in Death in Paradise.
Who did John Parrott would
so
be
you'd
there?
Have John, you'd John have various Virgo. The old snooker loopy lags who they just hang around the Crucible for 2 weeks every year this time of year. And then Len Ganley, referee, would be a suspect. Mm. And Robertson, obviously, and whoever's sitting just behind Higgins.
Oh, one of Def Leppard, isn't it? Who's the rock star?
Oh, the drummer from Iron Maiden, yeah, Nico McBrain. He goes there. Oh, it's Stephen Fry, Seat Thief.
God, this is if we send this, we could write our own line of duty, Barry. thanks, Keith, for that question. And that'll do for today. Paul Doyle, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you all for being so generous and donating all your money, etc., or just for listening. And we'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.